Welcome to Bounce Back Stronger, the podcast that explores ways to find peace and purpose no matter what happens. Today's guest, Billy Manis, wears so many hats. He's a writer, poet, truck driver, father, and a seasoned singer-songwriter with over two decades in the music industry. He is also known for his insightful Substack column, Manis from Heaven, and his contributions to Elephant Journal and the Good Men Project. But that's not all. Billy is the author of Kick-Ass Recovery, a powerful motivational and self-help guide tailored for those who face the challenges of alcohol and substance abuse. And he's working on a second book. This time, it's young adult fiction. So much to talk about, so I will need to stop introing already and welcome our guest. Billy, thank you for joining us on Bounce Back Stronger. As a longtime reader of your work and someone who has felt your support on my own sobriety journey, I'm so happy to get the chance to speak with you.
Well, thank you. I had no idea. I had no idea that you read this, like all this stuff.
Yeah, I've always followed you. I had Crystal Jackson on actually recently too. And, you know, you both were kind of in the class above me in Elephant Journal land, I guess. And yeah. I just always loved your work. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll start with the inspiration behind your Substack column, which has a great title, Manis from Heaven. How has it evolved over time? I just love that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know where I got the name from. It just sounds like whenever I used to hear that expression, I was like, what? You know, because I didn't know exactly as a young person what they were saying. I thought that's what they were saying. And I was a young kid before. See, there were no computers. All you had was an encyclopedia. And so I don't think the Britannica had manna from heaven is like something or you wouldn't even know how to look it up. So, right. But anyway, as I got older, I evolved and figured out like what that meant. And then.
And when did you start the Substack?
About a year and a half ago.
That's awesome.
And yeah, the biggest thing was that I didn't have to, there was like a format for Elephant Journal and I didn't have to follow that format anymore. I didn't have to do like 10 reasons why, blah, 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 blah. I found as a writer for Elephant Journal, it honed my ability to stay within a format and be creative in that format. And that discipline, I think everybody should have to go through for a few years. But once I did that for 6 or 7 years, I figured, all right, well, I think I know enough to be able to be a little more personal and not bore people to death.
But it led to you getting the Kick-Ass Recovery book, right? I mean, having all those writings and having some things go viral and things like that, right?
That's a really funny question because there's two answers to that. I thought that it did, and I labored under the idea that it was, which was probably not such a bad thing. I think being that naive was probably the best thing in my favor because when I finally did get signed and I did get an agent, I learned things that went on in the publishing world that it just went against everything I believed about everything. It's not a very pretty place to be. Yeah, there's a lot of cutthroat stuff and a lot of weird stuff. And a lot of the influencers with ghostwriters are basically what's getting picked up these days. And not like somebody who's pounding away every morning. I mean, it does happen with ridiculous amounts of persistence, but it's one of the hardest things I ever did.
Yeah.
So I think my whole idea of the way it was as I was writing for Elephant Journal and they were going popular, I was like, somebody's going to give me a book deal. And I just felt like I better be ready for this because, you know, I want to have something ready. And then, you know, little by little, as I learned and learned and learned how things happened, I just kept adapting my approach to more realistic pursuits than thinking that somebody was just going to come smoking a cigar, shaking my hand and being like, I read your article on Elephant Journal and I got a deal for you.
You know, no, doesn't work.
That was never going to happen. No.
Maybe let's talk a little bit about the different roles that you've had.
You know, I've had brushes with famed people. You know, I mean, Lee Von Helm, when he was still alive, lived right around here. And all those people from that whole genre, a lot of the people that were playing at Woodstock actually wound up buying property here and just living here. So I got to have conversations with Natalie Merchant and you know, a lot of different celebrities. And then of course Billy Joel's drummer from all those great albums, the one from 73 to 2003, Liberty DeVito. I got him to write the foreword. You know, I mean, I know the people who are like not ridiculously famous, but as far as playing with them, I opened up for the Cult. I think that's probably Yeah.
Who needs what anything else?
That was a pretty cool day. I have to admit. I think one of the coolest things about that was I had never been in a professional situation before. And I had this like mop top band we were all using. And like, we didn't have the best equipment because that's what happens when you're using. And at one point we're like on our fourth or fifth song or something. And I guess my lead guitar player's amp just sizzled out. And just like one of those NASCAR pit crews, I swear to you, two people ran out on stage, threw his amp back, put another one in, plugged it in. And before anybody in the audience even saw what was happening, he was already in a different amp and ready to go.
Wow.
I was like, that is the life right there.
There's angels that come on stage and fix everything for you. That's
yeah,
amazing.
That was great. That was great.
Maybe talk a little bit about that time. Like, how did you go from those days to going through recovery and then now being a writer about recovery?
Yeah, so my bottom was very weird because it was not very predictable. Well, I mean, that's hard to say. I mean, I guess there's always somebody out there that's going to be like, oh, someday. I was at a point where I was taking anything I could get. I did not care what it was. I was in a really bad place. I was like just turning 40. Everything was just blowing up around me. No car, no girlfriend. I still had an apartment, which is kind of weird, but I did. I was still earning money some way, somehow, mostly legal. And I think my next door neighbor had Ritalin. And like I said, I did not care what it was, as long as it was something that changed the way I felt. But you see, I also have Crohn's disease. And this particular time, I was really wrecking my body with the way I was living. I mean, not just the drugs, but the bad food and this and that.
Yeah.
So in the middle of a flare-up, I was on all this prednisone. And when the guy was like, oh, I don't have anything except Ritalin, I was like, oh, give it to me. So needless to say, when you mix Ritalin with prednisone, first of all, you think you're going to have a heart attack. And second of all, you probably will come to that point where you're like, okay, I think it's time to throw in the towel. And yeah. That's what happened.
That's amazing that you saw it. I mean, not everybody would have stopped totally. Did you end up in the hospital for that? Or
No. The story is I took a taxi to my friend's house in Kingston, and she was already in recovery for about a month or so. And we had like a camp out in her living room where like she was laying on the couch. I was laying on the other couch. We were both staring up at the ceiling in the dark. And she was like, what are you going to do? And I just remember like looking up at the ceiling and being like, I got to go with you tomorrow to a meeting. And that was it. Wow. That was the day that started everything. And that was in 2010.
That is amazing. And it just stuck since then.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought of why? Was it the meetings? Was it what was it? Or was it just hitting that point?
You know, it all comes back to Kick-Ass Recovery. It stuck because of that. That's what made me write the book. I mean, I did what a lot of people do the first time. I got a year. I had the cake. I had the big celebration. Same. Everybody telling me how wonderful I am. And then, 3 months later, I was back out again. But that's a common story. That happens a lot. Mm-hmm. Even though I went through so much shame and guilt about that, I see it for what it is now. And I see that it was nothing is wasted. Nothing is wasted because I had seen it work and it was already in my head. The seed was already planted that I could just go right back to doing that again. It sounds like really easy. It's not, because every time I picked up after that year, I kept trying to go back and the seal was broken and that was it. Like I kept trying, but then I kept going home and using. So it was like, then I just finally gave up. But the thing is like when you get desperation and you mix desperation with a prototype knowledge of like, oh, this, you know, I remember doing this and I was able to do it. That's the two ingredients, I think. And so it worked for that reason.
Yeah, getting an understanding of how it's affecting your body. It sounds like when you first had the sobriety, you saw how it was affecting your body. And it feels like, again, you were like, oh, I feel better when I'm not doing this. It really is that simple sometimes, but we have to be in a headspace to notice.
Yeah, I mean, that could still happen where you pick up and you're like, I don't want to do this. And you do it again. And I don't want to do this. But when I got clean the second time and I had my first year celebration, and that thing that happens after your first year celebration, where like all of a sudden there's no more keychains,
no more parties.
Yeah, no more parties, no more positive reinforcement, no more. That's when I realized, aha, this is one of the reasons why I went out. Because that's it. I made it to the year. I felt like I, you know, passed the checkered flag. And then that was it. I needed a different checkered flag. And so then I started listening to a lot of motivational stuff, a lot of Tony Robbins stuff. And I kind of veered off the NA path and became more involved in just building myself into something bigger and better. I mean, I didn't abandon 12-step. I got more involved in another approach. And then the two approaches came together, and that's how the book got written. Well, that and doing service in jails, that had a lot to do with it, too.
That'll do it.
Yeah.
They had Sharon Salzberg on a month or so ago. And in the book that we talked a lot about, which is called Faith, is you've kind of got to take it and integrate it and make it your own, right? I can relate to that too with 12 steps. It doesn't appeal to me, but I think there's a lot of things about it that are helpful. And it's figuring out your own path, at least for me, was very important. I'm not a follower. So I had to do my own thing. So I kind of relate to that. I don't know if that makes any sense to you.
Oh, yeah. No, it does. And I think, oh, God, how can I say this in the most benign way possible?
Don't worry about it. No boundaries, remember?
Yeah. I think for the more motivated people or the more shrewd-minded, I don't know how to put it, going by strictly the tenets of 12 steps and doing nothing but that and going to 5 meetings a week with 15, 16, 17 years, that's fine for some people, I guess. But to make a celebration out of not using every day for 17 years and that being like your pinnacle, I'm not going to make judgments. If that is like, that is great for you, then that is great. But I think for a lot of people, they need more. They need to feel like they did more than just not use.
Yeah, I think there's a real benefit to the community, right? I think a lot of what people love about is the community. For me, I found a community online that is a little less strict about the tenant, but they are there to support me. And there are times where if I'm having a really difficult time, then I will post there and they will be there for me. And I think that community is really, really helpful. So in your case, you also found purpose, right? You wanted to be something bigger, right? You wanted to write books. You wanted to do more with your writing.
Yeah.
And I think that purpose can be really, really helpful for us too.
Yeah, because I kept listening to all these Tony Robbins things. And
there you go.
And the only thing that was missing was, what do I want to do? Like I kept, you know, getting pumped up to do something, but I was like, well, what am I going to do? And that's when it was like dawned on me, you know, I got a degree in English. And like, that was always my first love. Just do that. And so that's how that happened.
And so tell me a little bit about the new book.
Yes. Well, I wrote one last year. And I'm trying to query agents on that right now. That was Ramona Clay. You know what a Ramona Clay is?
No.
Do you ever read The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath?
I have to admit, okay. I did not.
All right. It's anything that's like loosely based on the truth. So it's like autobiographical, but it's fiction. That's basically what my first novel was. I got into a situation when I was like 23 where I almost got murdered by somebody. And
oh my God.
The person, for some inexplicable reason, dropped the baseball bat and walked away. And it always stuck in my head. And I had this idea of like, what would have happened in 1993 when there were no cell phones and my parents and family were on Long Island and I was in Tempe, Arizona? What would have happened if that went the other way? Like, how would that have all played out? And that's why my first novel was. And then it just grew from there because based on everything that I was reading at the time, and I read a book by Saul Cassin called Duped, which was about all the people in our country that have been wrongfully convicted and false confessions and stuff like that. And so that became incorporated in the book. It was my first experience writing a novel. It changed my life. You know, I never thought I'd be able to write a novel. And when I did it, that was a beautiful feeling to see that happen.
And I think it's interesting because it does kind of stem from a real event, but you just took it to the nines, right?
And then, so when that was done, I had an idea in the summertime, this particular summer, right around Woodstock, April 16, 17, 18, about writing a young adult historical fiction novel about a 16-year-old kid from Long Island who has this tragic event happen in his life and he's struggling with his parents and he's going in and out of psychological facilities and stuff like that. Circumstantial things that drove him crazy. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like he didn't have any inherent issues. He just went through really traumatic stuff and he winds up leaving against his parents' wishes to go up to Woodstock. And of course he meets this girl walking across the Tappan Zee Bridge and we take it from there.
Oh, that's so cool. And a lot of good content there because a lot of young adults are dealing with a lot of different things and it's hurting their mental health. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. I'm sure there's a good audience for that.
Yeah. And also all the history of that time, like which I think a lot of these kids now have no idea like what the nuances of what was going on in 1969, just the year before the Robert Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination. Like it was a crazy time.
Could feel very relevant to kids today too. after the pandemic, which kind of shut them off for a while, and all the changes in technology and the politics, which we will not talk about. You know, I think there's a lot of ungrounding for kids now too. So
yeah,
they could really feel connected to that.
Yeah, I think it could work out really well.
Yeah, I'm excited to read it. We didn't get to talk about the Good Men Project. Do you want to take a moment there? I would love to hear your view on it.
I wrote about this in one of my recent columns, actually. The thing that inspired me to write for them was my first year of being in 12-step recovery, the second time when it actually stuck. I was befriending a woman that was, we were getting along really well, but she was, you know, we were both new, and she was like, we have to hang out with people of our same sex. And I was like, all right, whatever. So we became friends with these two people that were also dating. We weren't dating, but we were kind of like in a weird dynamic. We became friends with this couple. And so the two ladies went and did stuff. And then I was supposed to go and hang out with the guy. And I remember knowing for a fact that he had daughters the same age as mine. And at the time, I had a daughter that was 11 or 12 or 13, something like, yeah, 12, let's say 12. And we're walking into the mall in Kingston, and I see a bunch of girls go by, and they can't be more than 15 years old. I could just tell, right? And I look at this guy staring at them like they were like chop meat, and he hadn't had a meal in like 6 years.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
I'm like, this is like very uncomfortable, first of all. And second of all, this is why I don't hang out with dudes. Because I hate this, you know, like I'm by association, I'm with this ogling. So I wanted to express myself in that, the way that I felt about things like that. And then that expanded to like my ideas about the patriarchy and my ideas about a very man-centered world and incels and just all this stuff that I felt like I needed to say something about. And so that became, I guess, at heart, without trying to get too much credit for it, I'll always be a feminist because I have daughters. And I know for a lot of guys, there's disconnect there. And I see it all the time. Just like that guy that I went to the mall with, his daughter was only about 2 or 3 years younger than these girls that he's looking at. And I'm like, you're not putting this together that like there's a guy out there looking at your daughter right now, you know,
that's
like,
right.
But I don't have that disconnect. I immediately, when I see a young girl, I think that could be my daughter. And so that's how I talk and approach young ladies, is that they're somebody's daughter. They're not there to be
to ogle.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would you like to share that I didn't ask?
You know, I'm going to say something a little out of left field, but I think it'll be helpful for most people. As far as the traditional publishing and self-publishing, traditional publishing has some great benefits to it. And it's great to go into Barnes & Noble and see your book on the shelf, or to see it at a library and to say, I've got a Library of Congress number, and this is, you know, and they gave me an advance and I had an agent and all that stuff. It's not everything it's cracked up to be, because like I went out with my agent yesterday and I had to face the very real fact that like my book is not really selling. And you could very easily get your head stuck in like, because you're talking to an agent who's got many clients whose books are all selling. So like now you're not such a big deal anymore, because now you're, you know, and she did not go out of her way to make me feel bad about it. I was taking the information she was giving me and going where I went with it. So I guess the point is, everything that looks great is not as great as you think it is. You'll have just as many heartbreaks with self-publishing as you would with traditional publishing. You have to just want to write and just forget about what the results are going to be.
I can add to this. I certainly went the querying route with my memoir. A memoir about a normal 50-ish woman who gets divorced has been done, and you know, nobody would have picked it up, and didn't pick it up. So I published it, and doing the same thing with the next one. And I don't see a real need to go through the traditional route, because I want to write a lot of books and I don't feel like I'll get them published through the traditional route, just the way it is. So I get where you're coming from. There is no golden answer for anybody. I think it's what you want. I think if it's really important to you to get a traditional published deal, I think you can get it, to your point, if you continue to pursue it. And I'm just not patient.
Yeah.
But I think it's great if people can get it, because it does give you more expansion in terms of where your book ends up.
Yeah.
Thank you, Billy Maness. I really appreciate the time together. It's good to talk to you. I hope we get a chance to do it again.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all for today. If you want to learn more about Billy and his work, those links will be in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. I hope this episode was helpful. And if it was, please subscribe, drop a review, or share it with your friends and family. That's the best way to get it in the hands of those who may benefit. And if my daughters, Sienna and Sylvie, are listening, I just want you to know how proud I am of you, and I love you so much. Bye now.